You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Dan Oliver. Dan is the founder and managing director of Mermican Capital. In addition to quite a few years of investing experience, he brings with him a very sound academic background with a law degree and a BA degree in philosophy from Columbia, and also, I believe, a degree from Vanderbilt. I'm not sure I have that exactly right, Dan, but thank you for joining me again today.
Close enough.
Pretty close.
They tell you you go to school to learn that you don't have to go to school. So I learned that several times. Finally, the lesson stuck.
Okay. All right. Very good. I've titled today's show, Are Gold Share Investors Fools? I know you invest in gold mining shares. I do too. And it's been a very painful year for me. And so in order to answer that question, I'd like to discuss your recent article, Heads or Tails You Lose. You wrote it October 11th, just a month ago or so. In that recent article that you sent to your clients, you compared the stock market to martingale risk. Could you define martingale risk?
Yeah, sure. So most people are familiar with the kinds of risks when you flip a coin, heads or tails, 50-50. But it is an even outcome. But there's something called a martingale risk where you win most of the time. Maybe you win the bet 90-95% of the time, but the 5% you lose, you get wiped out. So in other words, the expected outcome is the same, mm-hmm. but the distribution of the possibilities is very different. And the example, which again is a historical example from an 18th century French mathematician, was what he would do is he would bet an even bet, like a coin toss. Let's call it a franc. If he won it, great, he won a franc. If he lost the bet, what he would do is he would double the bet, so he'd bet 2 francs. If he won that, right, he recovers his lost franc and he has a profit. If he loses, he's down 3 francs, so he doubles it again to 4 francs, right, and so on and so forth. So if you think of each series of coin tosses as one discrete bet, the expected outcome is one. He always winds up with one, right, at the end of the day. So he almost always wins. The problem is, what if he just gets it wrong, that the coin toss wrong again and again and again, to the extent where he's forcing his wife out, he's out of money, right? He can't make the next doubling because he just ran out of money. Then he's totally wiped out. So that's a great real-world example of how martingale risk works. And basically, the way Wall Street does it is pretty much the same way. You have the Federal Reserve that keeps the banks from blowing up. That's their function, right, is to provide reserves to banks and keep credit growing. And then you have the super smart guys on Wall Street. Now they hire all these MIT scientists to figure out where prices were going to go with all this credit. And credit tends to grow very, very slowly over long periods of time. And so like the martingale bet, you tend to win most of the time. You make little gains most of the time, and so everyone thinks you're a genius. And then what happens is you get these moments like 2008 or 1929 when all those gains get wiped off the table. And the conceit of Wall Street is, oh my God, no one could have seen this was going to happen. And so the people who don't understand the math and what's happening buy that story and think, oh yeah, it was just a really unfortunate, a perfect storm kind of thing. It was random, and so I'll give the guy a chance again. And there are two actual people, as I wrote my paper, who actually did this very self-consciously, and that was Victor Niederhofer, who wrote, he said, I figure I've traded about 2 million contracts with an average profit of $70 per contract. And he yielded 35% compounded returns for years. I mean, the guy was a genius, right? Who wouldn't want to have your money with him? Well, he traded his contracts. Well, right after he wrote that quotation, he made a bad bet and got totally wiped out. And he went to the investors and said, oh, gee, he was just unlucky. And they gave money again, and he made great, great returns until 2007 came along, and he got wiped out again. And so Wall Street people are naturally incentivized to do this, and there's a deeper reason for it, and that is that the way asset allocators look at investment strategies is they look at it, as I'm sure you know, in terms of alpha and beta. and these are mathematical constructions, which really, I think, have no application in the markets. Markets are chaotic systems that reflect value in individual choices. But anyway, when you're in a managed market, they do work for temporary periods of time. And beta is the measure of volatility. So if you were in a portfolio and all it does is do what the S&P 500 does, only at twice the volatility, well, that's easy to reproduce. Anyone can go buy the S&P 500 more levered up with margin debt and get the same results. So that's called beta. It's very cheap. You can't charge a lot of money to manage money for doing that.
Sure.
Alpha is when you get steady, uncorrelated gains, right? People pay a lot for that. They say, hey, you're a genius. You know, you're not worried about volatility. I'm not going to lose my money. You're just going to compound it slowly over time. Well, the best way to do that, the best way to get slow, uncorrelated gains is to sell insurance. And that's what AIG was doing. You say, look, you pay me a little bit of money every month, and I'll pay out if something really bad happens. But the assumption was that nothing bad is ever going to happen, right? It's proverbial selling asteroid insurance. I'll collect premiums from you every month against the asteroid. When the asteroid actually hits the Earth, I don't pay off because there's nothing left to pay. I just, you know, we're all dead. So it's the ultimate alpha strategy. And the asset allocators, who, again, I think don't quite understand what's really happening, look for managers that have really, really good alpha. And those managers tend to be people who are taking very, very subtle risks that maybe aren't very apparent. And they allocate them huge amounts of money, like John Merriweather, long-term capital management. That was the poster child. I mean, he hired Myron Scholes, who was the guy who developed the Black-Scholes model, right? And Myron Scholes described the firm's strategy as a giant vacuum cleaner sucking up nickels from all around the world. And this became made fun of, sucking nickels in front of a steamroller, right? I mean, it's just these very, very small gains you're going for, like the Martin Dale strategy, right? Yeah, and then all of a sudden, what happened was, as I'm sure you remember, is that they got some interest rate differentials wrong. The Russian ruble collapsed, and the failure was so large that the Federal Reserve had to organize a bailout. This is before 2008, before 2000, I think it was 97, or 98. And so again, you know, you can make so much money as a Wall Street if you have the right credentials and the right background, and you roll out these strategies. And again, no one quite understands them. I'm not even sure the people who do them. I don't think Myron Scholes was a crook. I mean, I think he actually believed that it worked, but it doesn't work because that's not the way markets function. These aren't free markets we're dealing with. These are manipulated markets by central banks that keep them elevated until the bank gets spooked, and then it you know, raises rates and the thing crashes down. It happened in 1921, and it happened in 1929. It happened in 2000, it happened in 2007, right? Bernanke raised rates to constrain the bubble, and it's happening again today. So, I mean, if you have to understand the cycle to understand when these strategies work and when they don't work, and my view is that at the moment, they've worked really, really well. Volatility has been incredibly low since the Fed got involved big time in the markets in 2009. Mm-hmm. And we've seen just the last few months that squelching of volatility has basically ended.
Yeah. Well, it's ended in part because the Fed has put its foot on the brakes just a little bit. At least it's taken its foot off the accelerator, perhaps you can say. QE is gone, and it's tightening. QT now, I guess they call it. So let me understand this for sure, Dan. Alpha, then, what we're looking for is above market returns, but with the same... But with no risk or with very little risk, right?
No correlation is the theory. So, if I'm some trader and I'm super gifted and I can day in and day out, you know, buy X and sell short Y against it, right? Like spreadsheets, and I'm just so good I can do it all day long. I don't care if the market's going up or down. I'm really good at identifying relational value, and I can squeeze it out. If I can actually do that consistently forever, I mean, that would be very valuable, right? Because you can say, here's a bunch of capital. I get some return. I'm not worried if the market crashed or not, because you're not long the market, you're not short the market. You're just doing these differentials, and it's great. And so, again, all these hedge fund people pretend to do that. Maybe some of them, you know, pull off. I've never heard of anyone actually does it over the long term, but that's the strategy. But again, most of them, when they say they're doing that, like Victor Niederhoff or John Merriweather, they're not really. They think they are. But what they're really doing is they're just playing Martindale risk. And when the system blows up, they throw their hands up and they say, look, no one could have seen this happening. All the smartest guys, the economy, no one saw it coming. So it's not our fault. So give us another chance. And then they get another chance.
And they go again. And and find a new way. So what you're saying is it eventually blows up because the system is rigged. It's not a free market.
Right. Well, exactly. Right. They would never work in the first place in a free market. It's just that markets are not free. They haven't been free for 100 years. And so, again, when the Fed is pumping money into the banks and the banks are pumping up the credit, you get big credit bubbles. And the whole time the credit is expanding, you know, these strategies work really, really well. And you know, just a segue into, I think, what's probably more interesting for your listeners, if you recall Michael Lewis's book, the Big Short, one of the hedge fund managers he writes about, was buying this insurance, right? He was buying it. That's negative alpha. He was losing a little bit of money every month as he paid the premium on these things. And then they didn't pay off and he lost the premium. The premium was very small, but it was negative alpha. And of course, his investors are furious because you're supposed to produce positive alpha, not negative alpha as a manager. And so and they tried to sue him, the whole thing. He had lockup provisions. They couldn't pull their money out, and they tried to sue him, the whole thing. Well, I mean, he was, you know, savvy enough to be there at the right time, and the market did implode, and he had huge payoffs in those bets that he was taking. And I analogize what he was doing to gold mining stocks, because the way gold mining stocks work over the long term, over the cycle, is that they're really a spread trade. The input costs are base commodities, right? Steel, oil, labor that competes with other commodities like copper and 10 sexier things, right? All those rubber, all those things that go into a mine, and the output's gold. So the real margin is determined ultimately, not in the short term, but in the long term, by the spread between industrial commodities and gold. And when the banking system is busy creating a bubble, what it does is it lowers interest rates, and that makes long-term projects look really, really valuable, because the longer-term your project is, the more influence its value is by interest rates. And so you run out and you start building buildings. I look at my window in New York City, it's like Shanghai. I mean, there are cranes everywhere, because all these things were they didn't start up yesterday. They were all probably planned 5-6 years ago. It takes that long to plan and build a building. So when rates were zero. And at zero rates, everything looks profitable. So they run out, and this puts huge upward pressure on commodity prices. Of course, gold does not produce income. You don't build buildings with gold or anything else, so it's relatively unaffected. And so the whole time the bubble's happening, your gold mining margins are being squished. And so it's like you're paying that premium, right? Because your economics, your gold mining are just no good. And then when the bubble pops and rates go crazy high, I mean, I'm talking private, not government treasury bill rates, but the rates of the private market, real estate, those sorts of things. All those projects get devalued. And I mean, for example, in China, when it finally pops, they'll discover they don't need a new building for 30 years because they've built so many of them. They're all empty, or rows or anything else that they've all overbuilt. So then all of a sudden, the demand for commodities disappears, and the value of commodities, industrial commodities, collapses. And again, gold is relatively immune from these forces, and so therefore you get a huge increase in your gold mining margins. And the more marginal your mine is, your mining asset, your gold mining asset is, the more sensitive it is to this dynamic. So again, it's no surprise that when the Fed managed to reignite the bubble after 2008, that gold mining didn't do well, because by definition in a bubble, gold underperforms everything else. And now that we're rolling over, I expect that the gold commodity ratio is going to shoot higher very dramatically when the music finally stops. We're still sort of teetering over the edge, but at some point we'll fall over the edge. And that's when the gold mining sector will really get a boost, and the junior mining sector especially so, because they have more operational leverage to the story than everyone else. But it goes back to thinking about, and the way I think about it again is in this alpha beta terms, right? It's a tough strategy to do personally and professionally, because you're like the Michael Lewis character. You're really making negative alpha in a world where asset allocators, you know, don't want that, and they can't explain it to their clients, and they just can't do it. But that's why so few people are in the trade, and that's also the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess you know, the question is, are we who invest in gold mining shares fools? And it sure looks like it for a long time, doesn't it? I mean, just as the other side of the trade looks like the, you know, you can't lose, right? They said it about a housing market in 2007 up to 2008. You couldn't lose buying a house, buying houses and leveraging up on the houses as well. But you can't lose by buying the S&P 500. We know that's true now, Dan. We've had 10 years of it. My subscribers are saying much of what Mike Burry's his investors were saying, come on, Mike, you're losing money for me every month. Come on, wake up, you know, make some money for me, right? So it's really hard. You're investing. I mean, you invest in gold shares, Dan. What sort of shares do you look for in this kind of a market? I mean, if you have cash, at some point you can buy these things for next to nothing. Boy, I mean, I wish I would have been able to see this coming as well as some people have. But and I have, you know, built some cash in my portfolio. But how do you play this now? And when do you know when the turn is going to come? And that's the big thing to me. How do you know? It could be another 10 years yet.
You know, it's well, I mean, a couple things. First of all, if you just look at the stock prices, you can't really know. And the reason is because stock prices tend to be fractals and that they're infinitely self-similar. You know, some of the charts of the gold stocks now in sort of micro time frame now look exactly like they did in 2014-15. You have these declines that aren't consistent on a percentage basis. There's not they're losing 10% every month. The loss percentage is actually increasing. So you get these exponential falls into these abysses. And that burns itself out. You can't keep doing that forever. And what it's doing, I think, is shaking at the weak hands. And anyone on margin, of course, is getting blown out of the water. And then, sure, as you say, if you have to sell it because of tax loss, you've lost your nerve. You really, really you lose on these. You know, the way I tried to mitigate that is, as you know, I think gold is going very, very, very much higher. And so what I want are stocks that are operationally levered to that story. But what I don't want are stocks that are financially levered to that story. Because what I don't want is for gold to take a big dip lower when the music really stops in the financial markets and have that be the moment that the stock I own has to refinance its debt, right?
Uh-huh.
Or the stock goes to almost zero and they got to issue a billion shares to keep the lights on, right? Because then you don't recover. Then the asset goes to someone else. You get diluted so much that you don't really recover when gold prices get back. Uh-huh. So what you really want are stocks that are not going to do that. That you know, if you're a developer or explorer, that have the discipline to stop activities and just hoard their cash. And you know, they dilute you 5% to keep the lights on, that's fine. But they're not going to do some drill program when the market doesn't care about the results and that they're going to dilute the whole stock to do it. And that's not really something you can discover in an annual report. It's something I think you have to know management and trust them not to do that. And a good signal, of course, is how many shares does management own? If they own no shares, I think they're inclined to keep drilling, keep printing shares, and keep giving themselves options, and they don't really care. I mean, not all of them, but it certainly tends to do that. If the management themselves owns 10, 15, 20% of the stock outright, they're a lot less inclined to do that. So there's that motivation. Again, there's just knowing the discipline and maturity and character of the investors you're dealing with. The same thing for the producers. I mean, most producers have debt at some level, although actually, a lot of them have paid back the debt. Going into 2015, they all had too much debt that they accumulated in the big surge after QE, and most of that has been pared down a lot. But I really want to see if I have a producing company with debt, is when is the debt due? Because companies almost never get into trouble because they can't make their interest payments. They get in trouble because they have to roll the debt. Expires. Right. They get a new debt at just the wrong moment, and that's when they really get in trouble. So as long as the debt is due, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years from now, I don't worry about it as much because, again, I'm not. I mean, the market might worry about it, but I don't worry about it because I'm pretty convinced that within that time frame, the gold price would come back and the debt would be rolled without a problem or even pay back.
Yeah. That takes a lot of work for people, individual investors. Of course, people can buy into a fund that's managed by people like yourself or other fund managers. The easier way out, it seems to most people, is just simply to buy an ETF like GDX.
Yeah.
Any thoughts about that?
Well, I do. I mean, ETFs work really well in other markets. And I don't know, Tommy, we have to explain it. But in most markets, the bigger the company is, the better credit terms it gets from a bank, the lower its cost of capital is, and so the more competitive it is. And so the bigger the company is, the bigger it gets. And ETFs are all cap-weighted, or mostly. So the ETFs, the indices have the best strategy, which is why active managers in most sectors can't possibly compete with passive investing, so-called. And gold is very, very different because it is not your cost of capital that defines how profitable you are. It's your grade and where you are and, you know, your metallurgy and all those other things. And some junior can come across an asset that's just vastly superior to anything that Barrick or Newmont has. And it's a bit of luck of the draw in that sense. So you don't really have that same massive amounts of industry concentration naturally as you do in the other spaces. And the problem that the ETFs have in the gold space is they're cap weighted. And so they gravitate towards the biggest companies, which are not the best managed. All these big companies want to grow, and growth is your enemy in the gold space because they get stuck in these huge white elephants with enormous capex expenses that always overrun, and then they get into trouble that way, all their debt. And the other problem is that the industry is very, very small compared to other industries. And so what happens, I know this firsthand from talking to people who run more liquid strategies, you know, mutual funds, that kind of thing, is that if something happens and gold spikes on a Monday and all the hedge fund people deploy capital into these ETFs and these liquid strategies. And now they have to deploy the cash because that's what they do. So they run out and they buy all their shares at the ask, you know, and push the prices up because of the liquidity. And then, you know, 3 days later, gold tanks and everyone sells their ETF shares. And now the ETF has to go and sell these stocks at the bid and push their price down. So you get enormous drag but by the volatility in the ETFs. And then again, I think that they wind up, for the most part, investing in the wrong companies because they do it really on the basis of size and liquidity. That's all they can think about is how liquid is this thing? How big is it? And as opposed to how good is it?
Well, you certainly make the case in your article for putting a portion of your portfolio in gold mining shares. I think you looked at the allocation of 30% in the Barron's Gold Share Index and 70% in the S&P 500, I think, going back to 2015, and that...
No, going back to 1915.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, 1915. All the way back to 1915. Tell us about that, how that worked out. That worked out very well, I guess. Well, and explain why.
Yeah, it's a rebalanced portfolio. So it's not that you buy 30% of one and 70% of the other and sat on it. It's that every year, annually, you reallocate it.
What it does
is it forces you to sell the S&P 500 while it's going up and to buy the Barron's Gold Mining Index while it's going down. And I was actually surprised the number was as large as it is or has been historically, the data suggests. But the reason it works is that the way you really grow capital over time is if you compound it without the big wipeouts, right? I mean, the drawdown in 1929 was 90%. Well, if you just had some of your capital out of the market in that wipeout, you did really well. So it actually reduces your returns sort of during the bubbles.
Yes.
But then you don't have nearly the same drawdown everyone else does in the crashes. And so you retain more of your capital. And so you have more of it to invest in the next bubble, essentially. And you know, what's interesting is it not only massively enhances your returns, but it also reduces your volatility. And what's particularly extraordinary about it, I think, and the numbers are really, you know, the math is weird sometimes, is that the Barron's Gold Mining Index by itself has been horrible. I mean, since the last 100 years, it's underperformed the S&P 100 by something like 87%. I mean, if you just had that, it'd be a disaster, right? But it just so happens that it has this incredibly negative beta aspect to it where it surges, it goes nuts when the bigger markets, the broader markets are crashing. And that's what preserves your capital. So it's not just, you can't just buy it, you know, blindly. And again, you know, when you take a formula like this and you backdate it, I mean, you know, you can design a formula to show you anything. But I think it illustrates the point that gold mining shares are something you really, really want to have when the music stops. And actually, I did some more detailed studies on this at one point where I said, okay, well, can you time these things a little better than just always keeping 30% every year in gold stocks? And the answer is yes. If you look at the Fed's balance sheet or the bank system leverage, you don't want to own gold and gold mining shares when that's very low. Like in 1981, for example, or 1933, times like that. You do want to own a lot of gold instruments when it's very high, like 1929 or 1968 or today. So I would also note that series is the Barron's Gold Mining Index, which are the bigger companies. And also, you know, you have to wonder whether these things continue in the future. Gold mining shares until the 70s paid huge amounts of dividends.
Yeah.
And they don't anymore, and there are reasons for that. But what it's done is it's made them more volatile than they used to be. And the reason is very simple, which is that as I alluded to earlier, these gold mining executives get compensated with call options. And the best way to increase the present value of your call options is to dial up volatility. And the way you do that is by taking a lot of debt and making lots of acquisitions. So they didn't used to do that as much as they do now. And that may change that dynamic. I suspect what that does is because they're more volatile, you probably want to own less of them now than you used to, because you get the same bang for your buck. In terms of upside, I mean, if you're all levered up and the gold goes up, you're a genius, right? It goes higher. So you need relatively less of it in your portfolio to get the same protection. My thesis is, these are the big companies, that if you go to the really tiny junior companies, which are not as well managed and which have less capital and generally assets that aren't as good, they tend to underperform more than the big guys in the bubble, which is pretty terrible if that's right. All you're doing. But yeah. If it's just a small portion of your portfolio, I mean, those things really go crazy. I mean, there isn't data for that stretching back very long, but there's circumstantial evidence. I mean, you get anecdotal stories of little gold mining companies, not just one or two, but, masses of them in the 30s and the 70s going up 30, 40, 50x from the bottom. And it's exactly. Because they go from being worth nothing or close to nothing to something. And there are lots of gold mining stocks out there today that have 1 million, 2 million ounces of resource in a decent jurisdiction that are worth $10, $20 million, market cap. And you can see that very easily going up 10, 20, 30x, when gold breaches 2000. Now, again, you got to be careful, because if you pick one that has lousy management and they're going to print 1 billion shares, it doesn't matter. You're not going to get the benefit. So you've got to pick ones that they're not going to do that.
All right, Dan, with just a little under 3 minutes left, how close are we, do you think, to a reversal in this equity market? It's looking increasingly volatile, increasingly suspect, I would say, this bull market. Do you think we're close to some sort of a turn here? You mentioned the Fed's balance sheet and when you want to be in gold and when you don't. You must think we've got to be getting somewhere close.
We're so close. I mean, I just read this morning that the Italian bank got bailed out. I mean, the banks in the U.S. Offloaded all their risk to non-bank lenders, so it's not on their balance sheets. And so all the regulators say, "Hey, isn't it great? The banks are in much better shape, and they're much better shape because there's someone else who holds the risk, not them." But they finance this stuff, and they lend money to these non-bank lenders that then make these loans. It's one step removed, but all the risk is still there, and all that means that when it blows up, the loss will be distributed more, perhaps, but the losses will still happen. They'll still be distributed. In Europe, they've made almost no reforms, and so you look at there were some bank of the Ozarks, I think, in Arkansas. That the stock crashed by half one day because it turned out their Miami condo loans were going bad. I said, what is a tiny bank in Arkansas doing giving loans in Miami? And the answer is, well, they were the most aggressive players, and so that's people who dealt business with them. But there are plenty of banks in Miami. So you look around, there was a big hedge fund in London that got gated. You look at Argentina and Turkey blowing up. You look at the Chinese bank system that got massive problems. I mean, everywhere you look, to me, it's like 2007, early 2007, when none of the little failures in 2007 were big enough to pull the whole system down, but they were symptomatic of really, really big problems under the surface. I think that's where we are, and I don't think we're near the Lehman moment yet, but we're near sort of the internal hedge funds blowing up that are problematic. And usually at this point in the cycle, the Fed is making at least soothing noises. Oh, we'll be there. Don't worry. Yeah. Instead, we got the hawks saying we're going to raise rates until the market cracks.
All right, Dan.
So, anyway.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it go at that because we're out of time. I thank you very much for being with us. It's very enlightening, and I'm sure, with this tax loss selling, there's a lot of good opportunities for people to pick up gold shares at just the right time, perhaps right now. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, Charles Hugh Smith will be with me, along with James Anderson. He's the executive chairman of Triumph Gold. And hopefully Michael Oliver will be back again next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
A gold rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.